6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth.
Good afternoon on this Wednesday, March 19th, 2014, and you are listening to A Public Affair. I'm your host, Tim Hansel, and on today's show, we are speaking with Dr. George Lakoff, who is the Distinguished Professor of Linguistics and Cognitive Science at University of California at Berkeley, where he has taught since 1972. George Lakoff is coming to town, and he's going to be giving some lectures, some of which are free, dealing with his thoughts and theories about cognitive our cognitive abilities and how that relates to the idea of framing and the use of metaphors. So, Dr. Lakoff, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
So, let's talk a little bit about you're gonna be here on Sunday and Monday, and you're gonna be giving some lectures on Sunday, March 23rd, it looks like you're going to be talking about the three E's, or reclaiming the three E's, economics, education, and environment. On Monday the 24th, the first of these lectures is a lecture workshop called Organizing and Communicating Based on Framing. And then also on Monday at the Haven Center, you're going to be giving a lecture called entitled Neural Politics, Cognitive, and Material Power. So, let's just sort of start there. If anybody is going to go to any of these events, what can they expect to hear about?
Well, a number of things. First, they'll expect to hear about why all politics is moral, in the following sense, that when a political leader gets up and gives his policy saying, here's what I think you should do, that presupposes that it's right, not wrong. Nobody gets up and says, here's what you should do, it's evil, but go do it. Nobody gets up and says, it doesn't matter, but go do it. Presumably it's right. And when you have two political leaders who say opposite things, give opposite policies, presumably it's because they have two different ideas about what is right. So what I study, among other things, is the moral systems that lie behind politics in America and other countries, but especially behind progressive and conservative politics. Mm. So that's the first thing that people can expect to hear about in detail. The second is simply some basic facts about your brain. Namely, you think with your brain. All thoughts are physical. They're in neural circuitry in your brain. And what's important about that is you can only understand the things that the neural circuitry in your brain allow you to understand. If the circuitry is not there, you won't understand things. That is, unless they're very close to what you already have. And what that means, particularly, is that if you have certain preconceived deep ideas and deep values, you may not make any sense of what ideas that come in that don't fit those values are saying. And we're going to see that this happens a lot in American politics, where progressives and conservatives talk past each other, and where simply reciting the facts may not make any sense, because the facts may have totally different meanings to different people, depending upon their moral systems, and certain facts may not fit a given moral system and will be ignored. So that's the second thing that people can expect to hear. The third has to do with framing. A frame is a conceptual structure that you use to think in terms of. It's very simple-minded. Imagine you go into a restaurant. You have a structure of what you can expect. You can expect a menu. You can expect waiters. You can expect dishes to be offered. To choose dishes for them to be cooked and brought to you, for you to get a check, etc. You don't expect someone to wheel in a patient to be operated on at your table. That's in a hospital and surgery, not in a restaurant. Namely, in a restaurant frame, it's a conceptual structure you have for understanding a restaurant. You know the kinds of things you're going to expect there. We think in terms of frames all the time, constantly. Any knowledge you have about anything that is general is going to be frame-based knowledge, and you're always thinking that way. Now, that is physical. There are neural circuits for that. And in politics, the frames are connected to higher moral frames. That is, they all have to fit the political morality behind them. The fourth thing you learn is that all words, all language, is defined relative to those frames. So that language is not neutral. Language is frame-dependent. And in politics, very little language is neutral. Most language depends upon the political frames that are being used, which in turn depend upon the moral understandings. Those are the kinds of things you're going to hear in general, and then the details get interesting.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about those details today, just to give people a taste of this this concept. So I'd like to go back to the brain and talk a little bit about this sort of concept of the embodied brain as sort of juxtaposed to maybe sort of the traditional sort of notion of the mind, which and reason, which is traditionally been sort of presented as sort of a neutral tool that, you know, you use reason to sort of investigate the world, and it's not sort of I guess I should say it's sort of distinct from our sort of emotional self, and our reason is sort of able to sort of, I guess, transcend our sort of physical states. But you seem to have a different view of this. Is that correct?
Well, it's not just me. It's all of cognitive science and neuroscience.
Okay.
This has been shown over the past 40 years or so. Traditionally, what I learned when I went to college back in the 1950s and 60s, that view of reason prevailed. And it's a view of reason that comes from the year 1650 about Descartes. Mm. And it's called Enlightenment reason. And it was very important in 1650 because it said, you know, we are rational beings and we don't have to have other people reasoning for us like kings and nobles and priests and so on. Extremely important in 1650. But here are the properties of Enlightenment reason. First, it's assumed that all reason is conscious, that you know what you think. Mm-hmm. It turns out it's roughly 98% unconscious. There's no way to measure exactly 98%. There are ways that people come up with that figure, but it's a pretty good ballpark. Consciousness is the tip of the iceberg. Almost everything you think is unconscious, and it has to be. And the reason it has to be is that in the brain, brain circuitry that you use for thinking is parallel, massively parallel. Hundreds of different circuits going in different directions all at once in your brain, but consciousness is linear. It goes in a line. And you could not trace out in time all of the ways in which you're thinking unconsciously. So, you know, most thought is unconscious, and what we've developed in the cognitive and neurosciences is ways of studying what that unconscious thought looks like. So that's one very important thing, mostly unconscious. Second, it's assumed that thought is disembodied. Well, it's not. You think with your brain, physically. Well, the reason Descartes thought that thought was disembodied, he said, was that if it were embodied, then the laws of physics would apply, and you would not have total free will. Mm-hmm. The fact is, the laws of physics do apply to your brain, and you do not have total free will. You can only think what your brain allows you to think, and that is very often limited. The third important fact is has to do with emotion. You might ask the following question. Suppose you have a brain lesion. You have had a brain injury or a stroke, and you can no longer feel emotion. There are people who are like this. The question is, would you become super rational, like Mr. Spock on Star Trek? And the answer is no. What Antonio Damasio, our great neuroscientist, showed in a book called Descartes' Error, is that people with such brain lesions, and he studied them, basically cannot tell like from non-like. They don't know something that they like or don't like, and because you need emotion to do that. And in order to do that, you have to set goals, and you can only set goals depending on whether the outcome would make you feel better or not. So if that's not something that makes sense to you, you can't set rational goals. And that's what happens when you have such a stroke or a brain injury. What that means is you must have emotion in order to reason and be rational. Rationality requires emotion. Now, some forms of extreme rationality could get in the way of conscious reasoning, but on the whole, the opposite is true. So those are some of the things that are important. Another is the assumption that reason is just logic, that there is one reason that's the same, and it's simply, quote, logical. Well, I went to MIT, I studied my math, I worked in logic for some years, and there is no such thing as one logic. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of types of formal logics that have been studied and that are being studied, but it turns out we don't reason using those. We reason using frames, and we reason using metaphors. And metaphorical thought is deeply, deeply important. We understand more is up and less is down. When you say, turn down the radio, you know, it's not physically going down. That's very important. If you say he's locked in the jaws of poverty, there isn't a physical animal that they're there. You understand that metaphorically. And when you go through ordinary everyday language, you are not only talking metaphorically, you are thinking metaphorically. And what we've done over the past 30 years is work out the details of how metaphorical thought works. What metaphorical thought does is relate different parts of the brain. So imagine the following case. Why is it that you think of warm people as being affectionate and cold people as being unaffectionate? Say he's a cold person. Or a block of ice. Well, the reason is this. When you're held as a child, you feel affection from parents, but you also feel their bodily warmth. So you have warmth and affection at the same time, but they're activating different parts of the brain, different regions. When that happens over and over again, when two parts of the brain are activated at the same time, over and over, those regions get stronger together, and then the neural circuitry expands. That is, you get activation flowing out from the circuit. Each neuron is connected between 1,000 and 10,000 other neurons. And so they're connected, and they flow outward, and then they get stronger. And they keep flowing outward along existing pathways until they find the shortest pathway between them. And they form a neural circuit. That neural circuit is the physical realization of the metaphor that affection is warmth. And we have thousands of those, what we'll call primary metaphors, structuring our conceptual system that come about through our constant experience from birth onward of experiences in the world that happen to come together and activate different brain regions over and over and over. The result is that we think metaphorically, unconsciously, much of the time, if not most of the time. And what we've been doing here at Berkeley and in other parts of the world, because there are now hundreds of places where people study this, is mapping out the metaphorical system of thought in our brains.
All right, well, if I can just interject here, I just want to let our listeners know that they are listening to Dr. George Lakoff, who is the distinguished Richard and Rhoda Goldman Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, where he has taught since 1972. George Lakoff is going to be in town here talking about his research in cognitive science that deals with the way that we reason and think and its connection to these sort of fundamental metaphors. And I'm your host, Tim Hansel. So, George, back to you. I want to ask a little bit about these sort of metaphors and their connection to our sort of moral systems. So you say you know, that these metaphors play this prominent role in how we think and reason. And it seems that you also say that they're sort of constitutive of our sort of moral systems. So can you talk a little bit about how these metaphors connect up to our sort of moral values?
Sure. Imagine the following question. Why should there be purification rituals in cultures around the world? And the reason is that we have a metaphor that morality is purity. Well, where does it come from? Well, when you're a child, when you eat pure food, you feel good. That is, part of the brain puts out what is called a reward system. That is a system of dopamine and other neurotransmitters that are put out and make you feel good, or others like norepinephrine that make you feel bad. So if you eat pure food, you feel good. If you eat rotten food, you feel bad. Now, what is morality about? Morality is about well-being. So that's why you have, metaphors where morality is purity, pure as the driven snow, or rottenness. That was a rotten thing to do. There's something rotten in the state of Denmark, says Hamlet. And the important thing here is that we understand morality through this whole primary metaphor system that we have. Mm. Now, among them are certain other metaphors that give you morality. For example, it's very important to have the things you need. So we understand well-being as a form of wealth, and this shows up in a system of what is called moral accounting. So if suppose I do you a favor, then you say, I owe you one. How can I ever repay you? It's as if I loaned you money, metaphorically. And we understand that. And you can pay people back for favors. And that can settle the moral books. Mm-hmm. But suppose someone harms you. Then what happens is that moral arithmetic comes in. That is, you said things like restitution. If I hurt you, say, how can I make up for it? What can I do to help you to make up for it? That's settling the moral books one way. Or you can harm me back equally or more. That's settling the moral books another way. Or you can take something good away from me, and that is called revenge. That's another way of settling the moral books. Or you can just cancel the debt. That's called forgiveness. You forgive us our debts, right? So morality is seen that way in terms of moral accounting. And that's one form of morality. Now, there are two others that have to do with families. In general, you feel you're better off as a child if you listen to your parents than if you don't, assuming your parents want to help you and take care of you. So you get a metaphor that arises in this form that morality is obedience to legitimate authority. You know, that is, morality is obedience of some sort. You have another one in which morality, you feel better, you're better off if your parents nurture you. Then morality is nurturance. These give rise to two different ways of raising families. A strict father family, where the father is the person in charge of the family who is responsible for protecting the family and, making sure the kids are taught morally correct things. And the assumption there is children are born bad and they have to be made good by being punished when they do things wrong. And the punishment is often physical. Mm. That is, often kids are hit. Now, sorry, I have a cold. In a nurturing parent family, you have a different view. There, the job of the parent is to nurture children. Sorry, cough. And therefore, to empathize with them and to make sure that you know what they need to help them fulfill themselves in life, but also to make sure that they can take care of themselves and take care of others. That's important. Sorry. Okay, so you get two different views of the family. Well, you're first governed in your family. So what happens is you map these family models onto politics and onto the market and onto schools and onto workplaces and onto religion. And when you do that, you what you're doing is imposing conservative and progressive systems. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, I have a couple questions, and I'll talk here for a little bit, give you a little bit of a break. That the first question that comes to mind is related to just the direction of causation here. So if we're talking about our moral systems and how they can sort of be described sort of via metaphor, I can imagine somebody saying, well, why not sort of think that there's the moral system and then we sort of cast about and look at sort of certain things that kind of fit that and say, well, there's sort of the metaphor for my sort of moral system, sort of a, you know, argument by analogy kind of situation. What is the reasoning? Because it seems like your direction of causation is sort of different, that you have the metaphor first or the frame that sort of maybe created during our upbringing and that causes us to have the sort of moral values that we have. Is it just sort of a temporal kind of thing, or is there some other reason to think that that is really what is sort of causing our brains to have those frames and to therefore have the values?
The reason is that these things get permanently structured.
Okay.
It's called long-term potentiation. And what happens is that when you learn them early, and they are repeated over and over, the neural system strengthens. What does strengthening mean? It means that you get more transmembrane proteins, that's a technical term, coming into the neurons there, which means that they will you'll get more neural firing, and they will get stronger over time. And then eventually they'll become permanent. Often by the time you're 4 or 5 years old. So, you know, you get a permanent structure of your brain often before you go to kindergarten, which is why early childhood education is important. Now, I don't want to give the impression that you are always one or the other.
Okay.
Because it turns out that most people are partly conservative and partly progressive in different parts of their lives and about different issues. And, you know, there is no middle if you're, what is a moderate? A moderate is not somebody who has a particular moderate worldview. It's somebody who is either a moderate conservative, which is somebody who's partly progressive, but mostly conservative, or a moderate progressive who is mostly progressive, but partly conservative about various issues. But you don't have a middle. It's not there. There is no such thing as the ideology of the moderate. And that's a very important thing about modern politics. You know, you might think, oh, we're going from left to right, but that's a metaphor. It says, oh, there ought to be a center. There isn't one.
So, well, let's talk a little bit about then, just to be sort of clear about how your idea sort of maps. So the strict father model, that's the framework which you'd say would equate with sort of a conservative worldview, right? A conservative moral ideology, and the nurturing parent would be more with the progressive ideology. So how does that sort of play out then in terms of policies and where people stand on certain issues like, say, you know, your three E's here, education, environment, and economics?
Okay. You're going to get different views of democracy first. For progressives, the idea is this, that citizens care about each other and that they act through their government to provide public resources for everybody, partly for protection and partly to enable them to live decent lives and start businesses and so on. The public resources are the obvious things, roads, bridges, sewers, public education, public health, you know, the internet developed through government research, modern drugs developed through government research, you know, satellite communication developed through government research, and so on. That is, we have all provided all these things. You can't run a business without those things. And you can't live a decent life right now without all those things. So, you know, you need to have food safety. You need all of that stuff to live a decent life. That's the progressive view of what democracy is about. Mm-hmm. Democracy gives you freedom, namely the freedom from disease, the freedom from want, the freedom from, you know, to communicate with others, the freedom to start a business where you have educated workers and communication systems and all those other things. Now, the other view, the conservative view, says democracy is about liberty. That is, the freedom from government, not to do things, but the freedom from being told what to do, and the freedom to do what you want, regardless of whether or not it's going to help or harm the rest of society. Regardless of that, regardless of, you know, so that you're all, it's all a matter of personal responsibility. You don't depend on other people, and you don't have to have the responsibility for other people. It's personal responsibility. And that, those are very, very different views of what democracy is about. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get into the details of that, you get to very, very different understandings of virtually everything. Let's take an example. Take pensions. A pension is delayed payment for work already done. And if someone cuts pensions, they're stealing your part of your salary because you already did it. So what's going on there is that, you know, people who are protesting about the cutting of pensions have a real reason to do so. But what I have found is that even though it's true that pensions are delayed payments for work already done, nobody says it. And they don't say it because it's the deepest thing in their brains. It is so fundamental, it doesn't have to be said. But it does have to be said, because not everybody understands that and needs to say it. Or take another case. Conservatives like to talk about job creators. But working people are profit creators. Mm-hmm. And when they produce more profit, when productivity goes up, they deserve a share of that profit. All arguments for fair payments, pay scales, have to do with that assumption that working people are profit creators. Mm-hmm. But nobody says it because it's taken to be so obvious that it doesn't need to be said, but it does need to be said. Mm-hmm. And there are many other things like this. Take education. Education is a freedom issue. If you're not educated, you're not free. You don't have the skills necessary to have a decent life. You don't know what the possibilities of your life are. You're not able to fulfill yourself fully. In short, you're kept from being free. Education is a freedom issue, and it's not talked about as a freedom issue. And when education is privatized, it's taken away from the public sphere, from what is given by citizens to other citizens. That is, it's taken away from the sphere of democracy.
Well, I'd like to give other people here a chance to join in this conversation, and we do have somebody on the line. But while I'm talking here, let me just let our listeners know that the Public Affair, I'm your host, Tim Hansel. But as I said, we do have a caller on the line. So, caller, what is your question or comment?
Good afternoon. I don't mean to be a Grinch. That's another metaphor. But I think Mr. Lakoff, sir, you've... since the 2004, the Bush-Kerry election, have found many ways and done a lot of research to determine that there's a lot of insecure liberals out there who shell out $25 or $30 per book to be told that that they're good people and their opponents are bad people. And I'm just very disturbed that you're doing so much to tell a certain demographic group what they want to hear.
Thanks for mentioning that. In fact, if you read my book, Moral Politics, came out in 96, repeated a second edition in 2002, that's not at all what I say. What I say is there are two moral systems, And from the perspective of each moral system, they're right. What I'm saying is that people who are conservatives see themselves as moral relative to that system, and people who are progressives see themselves as the moral ones, and the other guys as the evil ones. Mm. And that's just the case. That is what I'm pointing out. In fact, what's interesting is moral politics when it first came out, people thought that it was a conservative book, because I wasn't saying that conservatives were bad people. Mm. I was saying they were acting on their morality. And that's the point. Because all politics is moral, people will say what they believe. My view is that, let's say 47% of the people in the country voted conservative in the last two elections, they're not bad people. They're people who are voting their moral system. Mm-hmm. And that's what they think is right. And what we have now is a conflict of moral systems. There is, however, something important, which is a certain truth about society, which is that in the progressive moral system, democracy says that you produce, you work through the government to produce public resources available to everybody, which makes for not only a protected life and a decent life, but also for the possibility of having business and a market and all of those other things. And the other view doesn't say that, but that's a truth. And it's important to recognize that truth.
Hmm. So can I just, I want to talk a little bit about sort of relativism here. So when it comes to sort of values and these sort of different systems, you say, you know, within or relative to their sort of system that, you know, they're right. Is your view that there is no sort of correct or moral system, that there's no way to sort of adjudicate between sort of different moral systems and say that one is superior or inferior to the other?
It depends on your worldview. You know, from my worldview, which as a progressive, yes, I think that some worldviews are less good. For example, there are versions of the strict father worldview that has some people as better than other people, some people as more moral than other people, and there's a moral hierarchy in which, let's say Western culture is better than non-Western culture, or a country is better than other countries, or that men are better than women, or whites are better than non-whites, or straights are better than gays, or Christians are better than Muslims, or something like that. There are people who believe that. And I think, from my point of view, from my moral point of view, that's evil. Mm. You know, that is not moral. But there are people who say, yes, that's how the world should be ordered. The world is ordered in that way. There is a moral hierarchy of authority, and that is the appropriate authority. And there are people who will argue that. Mm. And you get all sorts of legislation in this country based on such views that I would consider immoral, but that other people think are just right.
Right.
Now, that is a fact about the world. But moreover, it is a fact about the way brains work. You know, we have evolved to have brains that have different moral systems. I hate to say it, but it's true.
Right.
You know, I'm a scientist. It's true. We have evolved to have them. That doesn't mean that I believe that anything goes. I don't.
But I guess, I mean, just to sort of clarify here, right, the worry about sort of relativism is to say, look, there are these facts, right? There are these facts that people have different sort of moral systems. There are different cultures with different moral systems. There are, you know, different individuals with different frames, or however you sort of put it. Does the fact that there are these sort of differences imply that there is no objective answer? Does it imply that there is no objective standard by which to judge any of these systems?
Well, first of all, there's no objective system of reasoning at all. And that's the next part of things. you know, it's not like there is an objective set of metaphors out there. There isn't. We think metaphorically very largely. But they have to do with the way our experiences come together across many cultures. They're the same because we live in this same earth, but in many cultures they're just different, and people do think differently, metaphorically, across cultures. Mm-hmm. They also have different frames, and they think in terms of those differently. All right, those are the facts, and they're not going to change. And they're not going to change because of the way brains work and the way that people work, live in the world. So, you know, if you're asking, is there an objective form of reason that is neutral, the answer is no. Now, you might say, well, what about mathematics? I have a book called Where Mathematics Comes From, and it goes through the cognitive and neural basis of mathematics, pointing out that there are conflicting versions of mathematics, lots of them. There isn't just one mathematics. There are forms of mathematics that conflict with each other, and that's an important thing to know, that mathematics is made up by human beings, and that often it's made up metaphorically. You know, the concept of infinity is not one concept. There are various forms of infinity, but they're all based on one general idea, of which is a metaphorical idea, which creates infinity as a thing. So pi as an infinite decimal goes on and on and on, but seen as one thing, even though it's infinite. Mm. There's a reason for that. It has to do with a very general metaphor in which things that are infinite can be things.
Mm. Well, I think that there's lots to be sort of said about this, but we also have callers who want to get in on this conversation, so I will defer to them. So we have a couple callers, and we'll take them one at a time. So we'll start with the first here. Caller, what's your first name and question or comment?
My name is Judy.
Judy.
And my question, I think, this is a little, the things are a little complex for me, but I think my question has two parts. One is I think it's expanding on what you were just talking about. Like you're saying, there's no objective or one way of thinking about things or framing things, or no one system of logic. And I guess I understand that, but there is. I think the host was saying this too. There is objective reality. I mean, certain things exist and certain things don't exist. And historically, certain things happen and certain things don't happen. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it is, you know, expanding a little bit on how people develop those frames. Like, I missed a little bit of the show, but it seemed to me you were saying there was a worldview that viewed, you know, that we're born evil, and in order for us to function in the world, the head of the family has to be very strict and authoritarian, and when we do bad things, we have to be punished, and another worldview that talks about nurturing. And I think you said one leads, maybe the authoritarian view leads to conservative thinking, and the nurturing view leads to progressive thinking. But I think that's to me, it's more, what about how you get a certain framework? Isn't it influenced by your experiences in life? I mean, a lot of people feel that various worldviews are influenced by your socioeconomic status, like if you're working class as opposed to what people refer to as the 1%. It doesn't mean you can't escape from that worldview, but, you know, and then the whole. So I guess my question is two-pronged. What about that? Like, how do you develop that framework? Isn't it more complex than what you were saying? And the other issue is, what about the role of objective reality and history in particular? Because I, as a progressive, when I look at some conservative worldviews, I think, well, don't they remember history? There's a lot that's dropped. That it seems to me that you would say, oh, well, I'm just looking at it from my framework. But it seems to me that you have to look at what really is, and you have to look at history. Mm. So that, I don't know if you understand the two.
All right. That's,
the two prongs.
Yeah, thanks, Judy. There's a lot there.
First of all, as I write in all of the books, there's a real world, no question about it. Mm-hmm. And the question is how we understand it. and people have different understandings of that real world and different kinds of experiences of that real world. And so, and it turns out, you can't understand it fully in its own terms, because you can only understand it through what your body and brain allow you to. Secondly, you're right that people are brought up, that the way you're brought up is going to influence how you think in all kinds of ways. But there are limits, which is the limits of the possibility of your body and brain and the way you're brought up, to, you know, and so on. Now, that doesn't mean you can't outgrow the way you grew up, brought up. Very often in a culture, you are exposed to many different worldviews, and to some extent, you learn, very often, people learn more than one, what I call biconceptualism. It's a very important idea that many people have multiple worldviews that are not consistent with each other in the same brain. They're what is called mutually inhibitory. The activation of one inhibits the other. Mm-hmm. But people can easily go back and forth between them without even noticing. So this is a very common phenomenon. And yes, your observations are right. There is a world, but that doesn't mean there's only one understanding of that world.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we evolved to live in that world, and that's why we have the frames we have and the metaphors we have, you know, in general across the world. However, there are many parts of the world where people live in very, very different situations, and they will give rise to different ways of understanding that world in a fixed brain, in a brain that may, you know, be fixed early in life and not change.
Mm-hmm. We're getting close to the end of our hour here, but I think we still have some people who want to be part of this conversation. Or we're talking with George Lakoff, who is a distinguished professor of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley, who's going to be here in Madison giving some lectures about these issues, which is fascinating, and unfortunately we only have the hour. We have just a few minutes left here, Professor Lakoff, and I guess I just want to ask about, given that there are these sort of different frameworks, it seems like a lot of your talk here is about how to sort of communicate between those two sort of frameworks, how, a progressive person, somebody who has the sort of nurturing parent sort of model in mind and a certain sort of conception of democracy, might engage with somebody with a different framework. I mean, is this possible? Are there ways for us to sort of come to consensus or to some sort of understanding of each other from these different frames?
Well, it can be very difficult, as you probably are noticing in your state,
mm-hmm.
And in my state, and in the rest of the country and in our Congress. The hope is this. There are people who have both worldviews, but use them for different things. These are the so-called moderates, the people who are mostly one and partly the other, about different issues. And if you are, let's say, you're mostly conservative but partly progressive, if you try to talk to someone in their using conservative language, what you're going to do is make them more conservative, because mm-hmm. that language will activate conservative frames and a conservative moral system. But if you talk to them from the point of view of their progressive perspective, that is, assume they are partly progressive, that activates the progressive worldview. Mm-hmm. And if you're a progressive, you can do that. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
I often have students who say, oh my God, Easter is coming up and I'm going to have dinner with my grandfather, and we always have these political fights.
Mm.
And I say, don't fight with your grandfather. He probably loves you. Don't do that. Ask him a simple question. Find out what he's most proud of that helped other people. Ask him that question. And what inevitably happens is that people come back and say, hey, I may not like what my grandfather believes, and I may not like a lot of what he does, but he's done a few very wonderful things for people, and we get to talk about them. And I think that's important, because what it does is allow you to connect emotionally with other people. And when you come down to it, I was raised around lots of conservatives. And I was, you know, raised in a rooming house near a Navy base. A lot of the sailors were politically conservative and very wonderful people. And I learned that they had different parts of their lives. They thought different ways about different things. And I learned to appreciate what they were wonderful about and to notice what I thought they weren't wonderful about and not to bug them about it. But rather live with them.
Yeah. Well, we do have. We're getting sort of low on time here, and I want to get as many listeners involved in the conversation as possible. And I know we have somebody on the line, so we'll take one more call here. Caller, what is your question and comment, and your first name, please?
Hi there. Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
I'm Margaret, and I think this is wonderful. And George, I've read your book, but now this program is making me want to reread it. I absolutely must, because so much of this is very, very useful. And one way in which it's useful, I'd like to hear your remark about, is to understand propaganda and not just the political propaganda for immediate political purposes, but things like, for example, military training of how to recognize who is and who is not the enemy and how to frame the enemy. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Margaret.
All right. Propaganda has to do with lying, number one, big lies, and big lies for some purpose. And that happens a lot, and it has to do, the techniques of propaganda are repetition, but the techniques of convincing people and changing people's brains as in advertising is repetition, the first principle of advertising. And the question really in propaganda is, do you believe what you're saying? And is this a truth, or are you lying to people to get them to do things you want them to do? That's what propaganda is about. And, you know, you have political propaganda going on all the time. Now, very often people will try to justify the propaganda. And they'll say, well, there are higher moral principles involved here. And for the sake of the higher moral principle, you know, that our country is better than other countries, you know, we need this propaganda. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that. I think you need to be able to say what you believe and say the truth. Framing is about how you think in the most ordinary way. Framing for the truth is what's important. I always advise people when they're talking about politics to always understand what it is they believe morally, to speak morally, and to say the truth, and not to use other people's language, but to use their own.
All right. Well, Dr. Lakoff, I want to just thank you for joining us for this hour. We've come to the end of our time, and I know that you're not feeling well, and I want you to be able to save your voice for when you come this weekend. Sunday and Monday, you'll be giving some lectures at the Pyle Center and then at the Wisconsin Union. So thank you so much for joining us in this hour, and we hope to catch you in a couple days here.
A great pleasure to be on the show, Tim.
All right, thanks. So that was Dr. George Lakoff. He is the world-renowned author, linguist, and cognitive scientist at UC Berkeley. He will be here in town on Monday, and just want to go through where and when he's going to be here before I sign off. On Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30, he's going to be giving a lecture entitled Reframing and Reclaiming the Three E's, Economics, Education, and Environment. That's at the Pyle Center Vandenberg Auditorium. Also on Monday, the 24th, a lecture workshop entitled Organizing and Communications Based on Framing at 9:30 in the morning at the Pyle Center. And then finally in the evening on Monday, March 24th at 7 p.m., he will be in the Memorial Union giving a lecture entitled Neuropolitics, Cognitive, and Material Power. This was A Public Affair. I'm your host, Tim Hansel. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Thanks to Keegan being on the boards and Yvonne working our phones. I'll see you in a couple weeks.